professor in religious studies, of course, affiliate in African American studies, and I have with me Dr. Alexis Wells Ngogome, who's coming to us from Vanderbilt University, where she is an assistant professor of, I get all of them, religious studies, American religious history, African American religious history, with an appointment in history as well.
And let's not even talk about the affiliations. So FM studies, women and gender studies.
Yeah, right. So her work clearly sits at the intersection of, at the very least, religious studies, African American studies, and women's and gender studies. And so we're really, it's our pleasure to have you here at the college and on the podcast. So the first question I wanted to ask is kind of a get to know you and what brings you here kind of question. And I know it could easily tread into the tell your whole life story territory. Right. So like, feel free to give a short version or a long version or middle version. But I was wondering if you could maybe share a little bit about your own intellectual journey to the point, you know, that you are now, right? You graduated from Spelman as an English major, and then, you know, received a master's in divinity and PhD in religious studies at Emory. And so I guess I was going to ask, what led you to African American studies and maybe even more specifically African American religious studies, right? The intersection of African American studies and the study of religion.
That's a great question, and I can give you the succinct version of that because I give it to my students at the start of every single semester. I think it's so important for them to acknowledge that your journey can take you in a lot of different places. This is only the beginning, and just giving them license to let their intellectual curiosity run free. So I was an English major, which I loved, and I was just reading this morning, that is one of the top five majors that people regret. that is a headline this morning. But I loved being an English major because that at the time was what I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to go to law school. But I was always interested in questions of gender and sexuality, and Spelman is a great place to do that. I always say Spelman is a formative experience just being there, because we're required to take African diaspora in the world for an entire year, our first year at Spelman. And then women and gender studies is a requirement, you know, so you don't get to say, I'm going to choose to take these to fulfill an elective. These are required courses, core courses in our curriculum. And so you're exposed to this variety of thought and just this intellectual universe, whether you're a bio major or an English major. So English was a natural home for me. I did AFAM Lit, and I just loved it. I had a lot of great courses in Caribbean Lit and African Lit. And so it just sort of opened me up to thinking about the diaspora in a really sort of concentrated way. But I was not thinking about religious studies. So I took one religious studies class with Rosetta Ross, who I'll be working, I see every year at the American Academy of Religion's annual meeting. But, you know, the running joke is, I didn't like that class. I thought it was, you know, it was fine, but it just wasn't my speed. I took this class and I'm off to do other things. And I really took it because a lot of my friends were in the class. And I finished college the semester early for a number of reasons. I did summer school and all that. So it was my final semester at Spelman. Fall of, 2003. Yeah, fall 2003. Fall 2004. I said, I'll just take this class. I took it, didn't like it, on to the next thing. Then I had this epiphany when I applied to law school as planned. I got into two of them, and I got scholarships and full scholarships. And so I said, oh, this is great. Now all I have to do is choose between these two law schools. And I just had this moment. My best friend and I lived together. She was a student at Spelman. She actually missed the LSAT. So she was taking the last one, and we had one of the worst accidents on I-20 that I have, I remember, I still to this day think that was one of the worst. Terrible. It shut down the interstates for hours and she missed the LSAT. And so she decided to do divinity school at Vanderbilt instead because she was going to do a dual program. And I remember looking through her course catalog for divinity and liking the courses better than anything I was seeing in law. And so I made a very quick decision, much to my mother's dismay. It was April, okay? So I had gotten a call from one of the law schools saying, we need to know if you're going to come here. I said, okay, just let me sleep on it. And I woke up the next morning and I realized I did not want to go to law school. And I said, I am going to go to divinity school. And I am going to become a preacher. And eventually I started in the ministry in terms of internships and very quickly realized that was not for me. And so I had this moment where I left after 3 years of divinity school and I went into nonprofit work. And I remember going one day back to Emory and I missed the stacks. I missed the smell of the books. I missed being in these dark spaces with my books. And then literally that moment I said, I want to do a PhD. And again, 11th hour, that was September. I ended up finding out I was getting a divorce, you know, from my husband 2 weeks later. And so it was like this moment, you know, PhD became a lifeline for me, like this goal became a lifeline through all this turmoil in my life. And so took the GRE in October, like the very next month. You can imagine there was almost little preparation.
Oh my God.
I called all my professors, can y'all please hurry up and write me something? Wrote a statement really fast, got my application in December. And February, I got the interview. And my divorce was also finalized. So it was like a new moment in my life. Got there thinking I wanted to do the ethics and theology. And my advisor, Diane Stewart, said, I really think you should take a history class. Mm-hmm. But then when I got into those courses on slavery, I mean, I couldn't let go. It was riveting. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I ended up here. You know, a very kind of, then it became history and very traditional training, you know, after that.
Yeah. Sounds like a lesson is listen to your mentors when they they know better than
they
you
know
do.
What they're talking about.
One thing you said, I actually want to go back to a bit to something you shared about Spelman, about how you were kind of required to take Africana studies, required mm-hmm. to take women and gender studies. It made me think of one of the most moving things you said, and it might have just been an offhand comment last night. You kind of reflected on giving this talk on enslaved women in Charleston mm-hmm. and how we're surrounded by the lives and legacies and afterlives of slavery here. And then you said, and you told the students, you know, we're surrounded by them. Should you adopt the lenses to see them? So I'd love if you could share a little bit about, like, you know, if you're talking to undergraduate students or you're talking to kind of African-American studies students, like, or people maybe who aren't in African-American studies, right? Like, what are, when you say, you know, should you adopt the lenses, like, what are you encouraging your average undergraduate to adopt?
So trust the process is what I'm probably saying. Liberal arts education, the model works, you know, and it works because it forces you out of these specialized modes of thinking. It challenges you if you use it properly. Now, I do understand there are students who use it like, I'm just going to take the easiest elective I can to get towards my major. And that's one way of doing this thing. But I think we are forming, and all institutions, I think, should be thinking about how we are forming better citizens. And not just citizens of the United States, but global citizens, people who are able to engage different backgrounds and different ways of thinking, and who do it in really genuine but respectful ways. And so for me, the adoption of these lenses are about not being afraid to confront the difficulties of our nation's history. because this is a part of how we got to where we are now. So much of the contention around political issues are rooted in much longer legacies. And these legacies cannot be properly understood without some sort of engagement with these histories and these different threads of thought that are coming from all different types of places. And these are the kinds of, that's the kind of exposure you get in Africana studies classes, in religious studies classes. You're getting exposure to longer lineages of thought, but then also histories, historical worlds, contexts that give you a better understanding of the world that you live in. And I think if you trust the process, you can't not see. Right. You know, that's the thing about liberal arts education. And when you do it well, you can't unsee the things you've seen. Yeah. And so once a student has taken a course with me in slave religion, they can't not see these things around them. They can't not see these legacies. They can't not ask questions about police brutality. And then, you know, the debt peonage system, and then, you know, kind of the legacies of slavery. They start to see these threads very clearly. And for me, as a historian, I'm always like, okay, well, let's stay in the pre-Civil War period. But I love the fact that they see it, you know? And so, that's why I say just trust the process. If you let it happen, you will see.
Right, you know? Right. Well, I want to ask you a little bit more about that, because you kind of, when you're telling your life story, you're like, originally, you know, thought my project was going to be on 1980s women. That was, you know, so that I could directly understand the present. Ended up going all the way back to the antebellum period. But then, of course, the subject that you've chosen, particularly, you know, what you talked about last night on abortion and mm-hmm. infanticide and reproductive politics and resistance, right? Clearly resonates with our present moment. So, I mean, I'd be interested to hear a little bit about, I mean, I guess it's kind of two things simultaneously, how you understand kind of the study of the past to help us understand the present, and then also perhaps where you want to caution us, you know, in terms of how we connect or think of the past in relation to the present. Maybe the way you caution students, like, slow your roll a little bit.
Well, reproductive politics aren't new. That's the main thing I try to get across from students. Even when we talk about, so in my Women in Religion course, we always start with sacred texts, you know, so we start with Torah, and then we do a little bit of the Ramayana, and we do Cherokee creation stories. And so we start there because I want them to see questions of sexuality and, you know, who plays what role and, you know, who has control over offspring for the continuation of a culture or society is something that people have been wrestling with for centuries. It's a powerful thing, you know. And I recently asked my students, why do you think it's so powerful? And they were like, oh, you know, they gave all these answers. Well, you know, everybody wants to control women and all this stuff. I said, yeah, but when you have a child, who is the only person who knows paternity? You know? And they're like, oh, well, I guess the mom. I said, yes. And in a patrilineal culture, and then everybody's like, oh, this is not just an issue of intimate private relations. This is a question of the continuation of political lines and, you know, economic resources, you know, who inherits the goods of this household. So these are really big questions that we're wrestling with in these very intimate spaces. And so with slavery, it's all connected to a global economy. And that, I think, is a very stark example of how powerful reproductive politics are. Because these women's reproductive capacities were being bequeathed in wills. You were being evaluated as a human based on your ability to reproduce children. And when you say it like that, is, wow, that's strange. But when you understand these children as the major labor resource within a global economy, a transnational economy, then you understand why it's so important to really wrestle with the implications of these reproductive decisions that women are making and that lawmakers are making for these women. But in terms of cautioning the students, I say, you know, okay, we see slavery. This is, like I said, a very stark example of why reproduction is so central to global politics and global economies. It still is, which is why we can't shake these debates. You know, it seems like they should be private decisions on one hand, but they're not, because they're rooted in just much bigger cultural ways of understanding human reproduction. But slavery is slavery, you know? I have students who work with prison populations, usually my master's students, and they always use the language of slavery, you know, to describe that. And on one hand, I get rhetorically why they do that, because it is a form of slavery. I mean, if you just look at the fact that, you know, prisoners are fighting California wildfires for dollars a day, you see that there is a real problem with how we use our incarcerated population and how we relate to them as a society. But then I always say, nobody has power over those prisoners' children. Nobody has power over their parents. So when they are there, they are concerned about their own well-being, but they have the capacity to just be concerned with themselves. When you are an enslaved person, your life is bound, all your relationships, everything that you think about is bound in this system of imprisonment. Your life is just imprisoned. And, you know, I always think about the formerly enslaved man. Well, I think he was a formerly enslaved man in Canada, but slavery was still, you know, happening in the U.S. But he had escaped to Canada, and he was being interviewed, and he said, you know, slavery is worse than the penitentiary, because at least in the penitentiary, you have hope of getting out, you know? And I use that quote for people to understand slavery is a different world. We're talking about mass violence, just period. Violence everywhere you see, the sounds, the smells, the sights of people being hurt all around you, you know, all the time. And people choosing to look away and choosing to normalize it, because that's a choice, you know, to say that this person's pain is not real to me, you know, because people knew this stuff hurt. They could see it in the tears and the eyes. And I mean, people were wailing and people were hoping for death and people were committing suicide. People were risking their lives to run away. So they knew this was not what should have been happening. But they made the choice to keep them there. They made the choice for their own interest, for their own comfort. You know, so slavery was a moment where humanity chose to enslave other people. You know, and they didn't see them as beasts. They knew they were human because they were laying with those women. They were having sex and raping those women, forcing them to raise their children. You don't lay with a beast. You know these people are human. So what does it mean when humans are knowingly violent and abusive towards other humans, you know? And that's the question of slavery. That's why we want to look away. Because we don't know what to do with that excess of violence and inhumanity in our, you know, how people would describe it. But it's really humanity. It's where human nature can go. So that's why I always like to say slavery is different because you're dealing with a very different world. And, you know, and it was enslaved people and freed people, and then, you know, the handful of abolitionists of very different backgrounds who forced this world to be strange to people. And it's still not strange to some people, but, you know, So that's why I always like to say slavery is different.
Captain Bato, you put to me the cayo.
With that in mind, I'm looking forward to your forthcoming book. For those listening, her forthcoming book's title is, I'm going to say provocatively, audaciously, titled The Souls of Women Folk.
Yeah.
Subtitle is The Religious Cultures of Enslaved Women in the Lower South. And this isn't going to surprise Alexis that I'm going to ask her a question about Du Bois, since the title since the title is The Souls of Women Folk. Like, I, you know, as I was thinking about this interview, I was thinking about how that title, The Souls of Women Folk, is a title that for African American studies scholars, for religious studies scholars, it's a title that makes an argument before you've even read a page, right? Like, you're already, it's already staking a claim before you've even opened the book. And so I'd love to hear a little bit about what you take your title to be kind of indicating and how you see your book kind of intervening, you know, it's in African American studies and religious studies in, like, the house that Du Bois, you know, at least contributed to the building of,
Well, you know, of course, I really love Du Bois, so it's it's nuancing Du Bois, because I always say you have to go through Du Bois. He's just kind of that sort of intellectual giant, and you read him, and I still get chills when I read Du Bois. So I really do like Du Bois, but so the title, a few things. So the book is suggesting that slave religion, of course, is not a gender amorphous category. It's saying that we have to consider gender when we understand religiosity among enslaved people, because slavery itself was a highly gendered enterprise. So the premise is very simple, but it's speaking back to the field of African-American religion in particular, because Du Bois has been he's considered the father of African-American religion because he's the first to write it about it in a very concentrated academic way. And he, you know, in The Souls of Black Folk, of course, he does the famous typology, the preacher, the music, and the frenzy. And I think how that's been picked up is in a very androcentric way. I don't think in its formulation itself, it's necessarily androcentric. But how we've translated that is in terms of very hierarchical understandings of religiosity. So our methodologies. When we go in looking for religion, we're looking for theology usually, not really cosmology. We're looking for a leader. You know, who's the leader here? Usually it's a preacher. Usually it's a male in a lot of the traditions. You know, even with the music, you know, we acknowledge that women are singers, but the people we understand as the masterminds are the men, you know. And so it's just the way we've translated Du Bois, not Du Bois himself. The frenzy has always seemed to be a woman thing.
I was thinking about that as you were saying that, and it totally is the stereotypical image of the frenzy is a woman in ecstasy.
It's a woman in ecstasy. And he cites a woman in ecstasy in there. Yeah. And then Hurston, who, of course, Zora Neale Hurston is one of my favorite. She takes it to the max with how she's describing shouting. And she's like, it seems to mostly be the women in here doing this. that's a woman thing, but that's considered like the less, it's like the melody, you know, so we know it needs to be there, but it's not what everybody's paying attention to. Everybody's paying attention to, you know, the lyrics and everything else. That's part of why the book is titled that way, because for me, you know, I say, you know, power, sound, sociality, and movement as kind of why Afro-Christianity became central post-slavery, or why people even performed it in slavery, because most people really weren't theologically understanding themselves as Christian. Why would they? But, you know, these are the elements that appeal to them and that they took and translated, you know, using these West Central African grammars that were still there with them. So a part of it is me kind of speaking back, using that formulation, gives us a less androcentric model, because when you talk about power, power is midwives, power is prayer leaders, power is mothers, you know, it's not just the preachers. And I argue those are the most formative people in those communities, not these every now and then I see you preachers, you know.
Right.
People, when they talk about religiosity, formerly enslaved people, it's like, my mama prayed over me. My mama told me this. My mama. And so we have to start thinking, these are not just colloquialisms. These women are instructing people, their children, in cosmology. They're instructing them in the relationship between the body and rituals and how do, you know, when you get sick, this is what you eat. You know, these are medicinal legacies that they're leaving. So these women are not just, you know, we take for granted mothers in more ways than one. And we do it
spoken as a true mom.
As a true mom. Hear me, children. So that's one of the ways I'm trying to push back on those androcentric models. I'm pushing back on the dominance of Afro-Christianity because I say power, sound, sociality, and movement are much more African-Atlantic ways that we can get behind. Because our quick move to Afro-Protestantism in the Anglophone context keeps us from really seeing all the ways, all what I call the excesses, which is the majority. So Afro-Protestantism is like this small piece.
Right.
The rest is all the excess. And how do we understand that? And I would argue that power, sound, sociality, movement, it helps us understand all the excess, which I would say is that's the religiosity. And then the third way I'm speaking back is this idea of, you know, third consciousness. We all know the famous formulation of double consciousness. But, you know, so it's, you know, who I am as, you know, I understand myself to be this ontological sense, who the world sees me as, which I always have to relate to. So that's Du Bois's. And then for me, it's this third piece of as women who were caretakers, you know, most enslaved women were the caretakers. I have to think about myself in relationship to these other people in my life, these people who rely on me. And so there's this third consciousness because women are making a lot of decisions based on their children and trying to provide a better life for their children. And as, you know, mundane as it sounds, and a lot of, you know, feminists, you know, will be like, but that's the reality of slavery. You know, it's back to basics. Mm-hmm. You don't have time for these existential, you know, pontifications about greater life because you got to figure out how, what am I going to do when I'm holding this child in my arms? I know that, you know, any day he or she could be taken from me. You know, what am I'm going to equip you. I'm going to tell you in the dead of night, I love you. I'm going to tell you if you ever get taken, this is pray every night, you know, do this, you know. And this is what, over and over again, the sources support this. Over and over again, especially when they're separated, they remember what their mother said to them last. And it's always something like, pray, you know, protect yourself, don't do this, be careful, you know. And so it's this third consciousness, I think, that, you know, not that men didn't have it, you know, that's not the point. But the point is that when we start with the experiences of women, we see very clearly that there's this additional layer of thought that Du Bois in this formulation, you know, in some ways is androcentric because you have the luxury of just thinking about these two things.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to think about this third thing is which, how are my kids going to survive, you know? And that's what a lot of enslaved women were thinking about.
Ooh, ladies first, ladies first. The rhyme, it is wicked. Those that don't know how to be pros get evicted. A woman could bear you, break you, take you. Now it's time to rhyme. Can you relate to a sister's open up to make you?
What's one article or book that changed your life?
Oh, I think I said it last night.
Yeah.
It's the incidents in the life of a slave girl. That changed my life. That I still tear up when I think about it because I think it's just one of the most evocative studies of slavery, you know, because of what she sees, but it also, the human conflict that is at the center of slavery is just front and center in her struggles with figuring out how to wrestle with hating slavery, but loving her children, knowing her children are enslaved, wanting them out, not knowing how to get them out and herself out. It's just all these conflicts that, I mean, any human in that situation would have, and her language is just so powerful. And so that if I had any book that I would say everybody in the United States needs to read, that would be the one.
I want to thank Alexis Wells-Ogogome for joining us at the college and for this podcast. And keep your eyes out for the Souls of Women Folk forthcoming.
Thank you.
This podcast is a production of the College of Charleston's Teaching and Learning Team.